League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look amazing. What have you been doing?
You've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, if you qualify, Zelthy providers can prescribe semaglutide, the same active ingredient, at up to 90% less without insurance. Done all online.
No wait at the doctor's office or pharmacy?
No wait. Zelthy can ship the same active ingredients as other expensive GLP-1s to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less. That's #250 keyword care.
I can tell you one thing that is absolutely true is that the team do not deliberately make a car for Max Verstappen at the expense of his teammate. And he's somebody who likes to have, you know, a huge amount of rotation. He likes to have a lot of front end in the car. You know, he's running a lower rear wing level and anybody else still manages to get a lap out of it because he can just wrestle a car that's, you know, recalcitrant around a circuit like nobody else can.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. In F1, the numbers never lie, whether it's the number of zeros on your paycheck, the thousandths of a second on the stopwatch, or the points of downforce on your new front wing. The points table for drivers and constructors tells its own story at the halfway stage of the season, with McLaren well ahead in both, Ferrari, Mercedes and Red Bull trailing badly. Looking at the underlying numbers, we can spot some trends and learn more about what's really going on this season. We did it at the quarter stage, and now at the halfway stage in this 24-round F1 World Championship, we're doing it again. To help us today, we have a very special guest, Dan Fallows, one of the top F1 engineers of the last decades. He headed up the Red Bull Aero Department from the Sebastian Vettel era cars right up to the first ground effect car and was most recently technical director of Aston Martin F1 team. Dan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We have a friend of the pod, former Ferrari and Williams engineer, now data guru in F1, Rob Smedley. Hi, Rob.
Hi, James. Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
And our very own Jake Boxall-Legg. How's it going, Jake?
Good, thank you. Yeah, I've spent the last week fully engrossed in Wimbledon, so it's nice to get back into talking about F1 a little bit.
Perfect, perfect. Well, plenty of numbers at Wimbledon too. Right, let's kick off, though, with the most recent race at Silverstone, won by Lando Norris for McLaren, that brought up the halfway stage in this championship. It's the 25th time a British driver has won the British Grand Prix, at Silverstone rather, in 75 years of the World Championship. It was McLaren's fifth 1-2 of the season, and that's the first time they've done that since the 1990s. But the most important number is that it reduces the championship gap to just 8 points between Norris and Russell and reduces the championship fight to a two-horse race. Rob, you agree?
Yeah, I think so. If we're talking about constructors, then almost certainly drivers more than likely. I think that, you know, you can never rule out Max Verstappen. But with the way that his season has gone and is going, especially after, you know, Austria, it's difficult for them to come back. So, and the McLaren drivers, they're always there, right? It's you know, much to the annoyance of probably all of their competitors on the grid. Even when they have a bad day, they still manage to pick up points. So, yeah, like you say, James, I think it will be difficult now for it to be anything other than a two-horse race.
And Jake, when we did this at the quarter stage of the season, you saw Max being in the hunt, never count him out, was your words then as well. But you also thought George Russell had an outside chance. That's looking pretty remote now.
Yes, it is. And I definitely won't be getting any work as a clairvoyant anytime soon. But yeah, it's been strange because in the opening sort of rounds of the season, it kind of looked as though Mercedes had got on top of the issue that it had last year. Actually, it just was just waiting for the summer months for those rear tire overheating issues to sort of come back to the fore. So they're not truly fully solved. It was suspected that this suspension upgrade that they brought back in Imola was able to kind of mitigate that a little bit. But again, it's been really hit or miss over the summer months. And when it's cool, you can expect the cars to perform. But unfortunately, that's just not the case all the time. So I think Russell has fallen out of contention here.
So Piastri leads 10 podiums, 5 wins, 234 points. Norris, 10 podiums, 4 wins, 226. Then all the way back to 165 points, Max Verstappen, 5 podiums and just 2 race victories in the first half of this season. George Russell, 5 podiums, 1 race victory and 147 points, with then the 2 Ferrari drivers trailing some way behind. In the constructors, it's McLaren on 460 points, which is more than Ferrari and Mercedes in second and third places put together. Dan, you know this feeling. What does it feel like inside a team when you've got a dominant car like this? And are you surprised that McLaren have managed to get this level of advantage with a customer Mercedes engine up against these, you know, these giants of the last few years, Red Bull, Mercedes and Ferrari?
Well, I think in terms of the feeling, there will be people in the team who've sort of been there and done that before. And I know that seems a bit cynical, but one of the things that, you know, the old hands will be feeling now is a certain level of trepidation. I think, especially going into a big rule change for 2026, it's nice to enjoy the sort of fruits of your labour, but I think there'll be a certain element of, you know, not wanting the team to become complacent. You know, there'll be people in that team in McLaren who haven't necessarily seen that level of success before. You know, maybe some fairly young people who haven't seen that before. And it's important to get across to them that, you know, you can't, there's nothing special about the team going into a new regulation set. They're going to have to work just as hard, if not harder, to keep that momentum going. So I think that's the first thing. How have they managed to do it? Well, I think, I mean, it's incredibly impressive. I think since they made a kind of leap in performance in 23, what I think has been impressive is that, you know, some of their updates have not been, you know, visually very striking, but they've clearly had a plan. They've stuck to it and they've decided on a philosophy on how to improve the car, and they've just sort of gradually nibbled away at it and just got quicker and quicker. I mean, I know, you know, from personal experience and as people do across the grid, these regulations are very tricky to make reliable performance, to put something on the car and to just annoy it that it'll work. But they seem to be able to do that. And I think that's probably been the most impressive thing. The fact that they're a customer now is probably less relevant. You know, the Mercedes power unit is very good, but I think most of the power units are, at this stage of the regulations, fairly consistently good as well. They make their own gearboxes. They do enough of the car to be able to make a difference. And I think that's just what they've done. They've just consistently managed to put those upgrades on the car. They reliably work and they've just kept their head above everybody else.
I have to ask you, Rob Marshall went there a few years ago, and that kind of broadly overlays with when they had an uptick in performance in the months that follow. Formula One is not about one person anymore, as you know better than anybody. It's a team of 1,000. But when you look at that situation, do you see the kind of signature of Rob Marshall, and do you feel like he's in the thick of this McLaren renaissance?
Well, we used to call him Uncle Rob. He's a lovely chap. And, you know, I think that is probably part of his impact in many ways. He's a good person to pull people together. He's got no artifice or doesn't play politics. And sometimes, particularly with this regulation set, where it's very important to be able to link up, you know, particularly aerodynamics and the vehicle dynamics side of things, it's very important to get the suspension working with the aero in the right way. He's somebody who can help sort of bridge the gap between departments. You know, I don't know how well they were working before, but he's certainly somebody who can do that. But also he's a great innovator. So if they have particular problems, particularly on the mechanical side, he's somebody who's very good at coming up with creative solutions for that. I think we've seen some interesting innovations from them on the suspension, for example. And I'm not saying it was necessarily him, but it's certainly got his name all over it, I think. You know, and he's able to do that, and also able just to be that kind of figurehead, somebody to go and talk to. And it's very useful in a team that particularly is under a lot of stress. So, yeah, I think he probably has had an impact.
Well, McLaren, as I said, now have 460 points after 12 races, halfway through this season. The record full season total was 759 set by Red Bull a few years ago. So McLaren are on course to smash that record this season, especially as we expect development to tail off from all the cars in the second half of the season. We'll get onto that in a moment. Rob, is this now the case study for having two strong young drivers rather than the old, let's have a worldie in one car and a subservient teammate in the other, or the veteran and the rookie model? What do you think?
I think the old adage, you know, in Formula One is true here, that you need to be good at everything, right? So I don't think that, you know, it's like, do you want to choose, do you trade off, you know, really good aerodynamic performance for really poor tire performance? No, of course you don't. You find wherever the optimized trade is. And it's the same with your driver pairing, I would say. I'm not sure that McLaren is the case study for this. I think that McLaren are just doing it right. Whether or not that it's absolutely true that there are no bad drivers in Formula One, I don't know. But what you can say is when you get up to the sharp end of the grid, all the drivers are pretty handy. All the drivers are very, very good. McLaren have two essentially homegrown drivers who they had to start off as rookies. Don't forget, it's not that long ago that Oscar Piastri was a rookie. But now they've got into their rhythm. They've got enough experience that, and not only enough experience of driving the car, but I think with drivers, you have to gain experience of like milestone experience as well, like your first podium, your first race win, eventually your first world championship, because before you've done all of that, you don't know how to do it. Once you've done it, then things start to slot into place and you can be more repeatable. So I think that McLaren have got it right. I think that, but I'm not sure that they're the single most case study. You know, I don't think it's ever right to have, you know, one great driver and one mediocre driver. Or like I think you described it, James, as a rookie and a veteran. I think you always want two good drivers. It's like anything that you're doing with a Formula One team. You want to optimize wherever you can. So if you can optimize two very good drivers, then you're in a significantly better position. Of course, two very good drivers who, like, let's call them two number one drivers, can often bring problems as well, right? You know, if you look at what happened in Mercedes when they started their dominant period back in 2014 with Lewis and Rosberg, you know, that brought about a whole host of problems. McLaren seemed to be managing that quite well. So if there is a case study here of McLaren doing it right, I don't want to say unprecedented, but certainly there's not many examples of this, then, you know, having two very good drivers and being able to manage them and keep all the emotions under wraps and not let that spill into some kind of toxic relationship that affects the team, I think that's a really good case study.
Dan, what do you make of this? I mean, you've experienced all kinds of driver pairings in your career in Formula One. What do you like about the way McLaren are doing this, and what have you experienced that works for you as a driver pairing model?
I think the key thing really for the sort of engineering teams is to have drivers who would quite like similar things out of the car, and where it becomes hardest is when you have drivers who, I think as Rob said, you know, they're all talented, they're all capable of putting in good lap times. You might argue some are able to put in better lap times, but, you know, generally they're going to be quick. But they all have opinions. Drivers have a lot of opinions, and they like to tell you about the opinions as well quite often. And it's quite handy if those opinions are the same. And actually, it causes more confusion and problems if they're disagreeing on, you know, where particularly the development of the car needs to go. So quite often you get in a race debrief, you'll have the specifics of, you know, the circuit and the climatic conditions and how the car behaved and everything else and how the setup direction went, which is, you know, 99% of the time wrong, according to the drivers. But either way, you'll come out of the weekend and everybody will want to have a kind of overarching opinion. Okay, what do we go back to the factory with? What do we say to the development groups and ask them to do? And it's much harder if you have a driver pairing who give you different answers on that. And I think that's where you get into a situation where if you have a driver who maybe has been at the team for a while and you've got a new driver coming in, you know, there is going to be, whether it's intentional or not, there's going to be a certain amount of the team listening more to them. And I think unless the new driver comes in is very strong, very quick, then there's inevitably the team are going to probably follow what their original driver said. And so I think that's why it's quite important to have a sort of balance if you can.
That's what people say about Red Bull and how they've ended up where they are, where you've got Max Verstappen and, you know, doing all the heavy lifting there, basically, and the second car only producing 7 points. Is that what you see when you look at Red Bull then, Dan, that they've ended up developing a car for Max's liking and the nobody else can drive it?
It's tricky. I mean, I don't want to stray into the area of conspiracy theories, because I can tell you one thing that is absolutely true is that the team do not deliberately make a car for Max Verstappen at the expense of his teammate. That I can tell you 100% that does not happen. So there is no kind of grand conspiracy theory to make sure that their second driver is, you know, looks worse than Max does. That's not true. But I think there is an inevitability to following the driver that you know better. Maybe they know the team better, so they're able to communicate what they want more effectively. You know, they spend quite a bit of time with various elements of the team. You know, they'll be part of the race team. They'll have people who come in and out of the race team who are engineers who then take that message back to their own development teams in aerodynamics or vehicle science, for example. The drivers will spend time on the simulator as well. They'll have access to more and different engineers at the time. And they're able to make their voice heard. You know, if they've got in the case of Max Verstappen, he's somebody who likes to have, you know, a huge amount of rotation in the car. He likes to have a lot of front end in the car, and that's his main goal, almost to the point where he says, you know, just I'll live with the back end of the car. That's not entirely true, but he will, to some extent, live with a very lively car. And you see that in low grip conditions. Silverstone, we saw it again. You know, he's running a lower rear wing level and anybody else still manages to get a lap out of it, because he can just wrestle a car that's, you know, recalcitrant around a circuit like nobody else can. That kind of behavior doesn't necessarily suit other drivers. But if you've got a driver who is saying to you very loudly and clearly, I need a very specific thing out of this car, then inevitably the team is going to try to help him do that without necessarily thinking, actually, you know what, we need to look after the other one. So, even though it's not deliberate, I think there is an element of that happening for sure.
Interesting. Well, Jake, Oscar Piastri, leading the championship, is now on a 29 race points scoring streak. So one data point that's absolutely clear and obvious is there is no substitute for consistency, is there? That's the third longest points scoring streak in F1 history, and there doesn't seem to be any sign of, yes, he had a few wobbles at Silverstone, made a little mistake, of course, behind the safety car that I'm sure he won't make again, although Verstappen certainly made that look as bad as he possibly could. Part of the game in motor racing as well as in politics is to make the other guy have a bad day as often as you possibly can, and he certainly achieved that. But this third longest point scoring streak, it's pretty remarkable for someone who's so early still in his Formula One career.
And I think it's quite a testament to just how level-headed he is, in that he has this sort of great sort of mechanic. I know it's maybe not such a thing these days in modern Formula One, but mechanical sensibility is still part of it. You still don't want to overpush in the races and do anything that to the detriment of the car. He doesn't get into needless sort of squabbles. I guess Austria was kind of the point at which he flew closest to the sun, but with that turn four lunge on Lando that nearly ended up in contact. But I think as soon as the radio message came through that, Oscar, let's not do this again, it became pretty clear that he knew where the limit was at that point. So it is testament to that consistency. And you do sort of tend to see this more in current Formula One, where reliability isn't so much of a factor, that the drivers are able to kind of rack up point streak after point streak. But to do it with such sort of longevity over the last two seasons, yeah, it's very, very impressive. And also, I think the other salient factor to that is the way that Piastri is able to recover positions as well. And we saw that in last year's season finale, and we saw that in the opening race of this season as well. Sure, the McLaren is an amazing car, and it facilitates those kinds of drives back through the field, but that Piastri doesn't sort of give up and just drive around for another 60 odd laps and end up P14, P15, that he wants to get back into the points because he knows that this is the point at which, you know, championships hinge upon. Every single last point matters. And he seems to have this sort of brilliant big picture view of how to build a season together, how to put a championship challenge together. And I think ever since sort of the middle end of 2024, where he seemed to crack the code a little bit with in-race tyre management, he's just sort of hit new heights. So it's just been super impressive from him.
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, he's got 10 podiums. And one man who's waited a very long time for his first was Nico Hülkenberg, undoubtedly the feel-good story of the British Grand Prix, Hülkenberg's podium for Sauber. Some amazing numbers on this one. It's the longest career in F1 history before scoring a first podium. That's 238 Grand Prix over 15 years. It's the first Sauber podium finish since Japan 2012, 13 years ago, Kamui Kobayashi. He's the first German to finish on the podium since Sebastian Vettel at the 2021 Azerbaijan Grand Prix, which is remarkable when you think about what a rush of Germans we had in recent times in Formula One. And he's also the oldest first-time podium finisher at the age of 37 since the 1973 Spanish Grand Prix. Anyone would like to have a guess about who that was that 52 years ago was older than him when he got his first podium? It was a driver called George Folmer, who I believe was an American. I'm not sure if he had another podium after that. And I wonder whether Nico is going to have another podium after that. But an amazing story, nevertheless, and everybody pretty happy about it. And the final numbers here was Sauber jumping up to sixth place in the Constructors' Championship as a result, now challenging Williams and ahead of RB and Aston. Last year, they scored 4 points in the whole season at Sauber, and now they're, as I say, up to sixth. Dan, is this the Jonathan Wheatley effect? Another one of your old colleagues who's gone out in the diaspora and is stirring things up. Was it just the low hanging fruit that he's been able to get here, or do you see Sauber on the up?
I'm tempted that he might say that he was instrumental in it. He might say that it was all him. I don't know. Jonathan's a hell of a character. He's very, you know, very likable. I think he would have made a big impact when he arrived. And I think it's unlike, you know, he didn't come from the technical side of Red Bull, but he will have heard some things and he will know some aspects of what they're doing. It's possible that he gave some sort of nuggets of information to the technical team and things that, you know, just things that he'd sort of learned along the way that maybe they should be pursuing. I don't think that's likely to be the reason they've kind of seen more success than they did last season. They have had another couple of people arrive as well, so it's not necessarily that. But I think what's interesting, I mean, we have seen that their pit stops, I think they've had some pretty quick pit stops as well, which is something that he's more likely to have sort of immediately got his teeth into because he knows a lot about that. He did a huge amount of work on getting Red Bull into a really good position. So he would have been able to make an impact on that straight away. But I think it comes down to maybe one of those things about Formula One teams that's a bit intangible. But when you have a certain amount of optimism and a feeling that the team is going somewhere, it does generate different responses from people throughout the team. You know, there is a kind of feeling, a momentum, a kind of energy about the team that shifts when you believe that things are changing. And they've had, you know, a trickier financial situation than maybe some other teams have had. They haven't necessarily been able to see a clear view of the future. And even though that they knew they were turning into Audi, I think inside the team, it sometimes doesn't really sort of hit home until the big sort of cogs start to fall into place. And he is one of the biggest, really. I think he's quite larger than life. He would have turned up. I see he went to go and see the engine facility as well in Germany. I think he would have, you know, given a rousing speech and gone around and spoken to people. And that's the kind of time when people start to feel that, you know, do you know what? We're in a team that's going somewhere here that's got prospects. And that does make a difference. You know, people just put that little bit of extra energy into what they're doing. And some of those ideas, you know, come to fruition at the right time. He may have greased the wheels to allow them to get parts on the car that maybe would have had to wait a bit longer or weren't even being thought about putting there, you know, all these little things that can happen. And suddenly you've got a more competitive car. So, yeah, it's difficult to see how he could be directly involved. But I think all of that kind of thing does play into it.
You're listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Rob, I saw Jonathan after the Grand Prix in Silverstone and had a beer with him, and he was in a fantastic mood, going around giving everyone big hugs. But at the same time, you could see that in his eyes that yes, he was really happy that he got this podium, and I guess it buys him some goodwill within the team. You know, that will go quite a long way, as Dan was saying. At the same time, he's used to coming from a culture where he's used to winning races and winning world championships, and you can see that that's where. You know, his head is really at, and you know all about that, as Dan does as well, having been part of winning and dominant teams. As he manages that transition now to Audi, how does he kind of leverage that goodwill that's been created so far? And what do you think about what you hear about Audi's chances of being competitive next year?
Well, I think first off, I think Dan got it spot on. It feels like Sauber to me feels really analogous to when I went to Williams with Pat Simmons, and it was really a team. You know, Pat had spent his, he'd spent dominant years at Renault. Then he had a few years out. I was coming off the back of quite a dominant period at Ferrari. And I think that, you know, when you're in a team, when you're in teams like that, you know, teams that have dominant periods, there's a huge amount of confidence, which is blended with a huge amount of introspection as well. You know, you never want to let yourself or the team get arrogant. But if it goes the other way, that introspection, and you start to, and it starts to become self-doubt, I think it becomes very difficult. So I think Dan's spot on that. You know, somebody like Jonathan, Mattia as well, my old teammate from Ferrari, Mattia Binotto, those two guys who have stature in the sport, stature in the industry. You know, they have been there and seen. You know, been part of you know, very, very good outfits, they do bring a certain amount of optimism. And like I said, it feels analogous to when I went to Williams, and the team was very pessimistic. It was almost lost. There is low hanging fruit that you can bring by just motivating the team. You know, the team is not full of it's not full of mediocre people. It will be full of very good people. And what I noticed over the last 2 years, just kind of hanging round with Sauber at times, you know, during race weekends, was there was no optimism. There was no motivation. You know, they almost were expecting themselves to turn up at a Grand Prix and not get any points. And I think when you turn that round and everybody tries, you know, that 1-3% harder, and you put processes in place and you start to, you know, bring more capability into the team, it can definitely start that upward trend. So I think what Jonathan, Mattia, you know, the senior guys have to use now is this momentum that they're building. You know, they don't want it to falter. They want to keep going forward. It can't just be built on all the low hanging fruit, though. There has to be a lot of stuff that they're doing, you know, at the more strategic end of the scale. You know, they have to be building stuff that is going to be bearing fruit in 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months, whatever it is. So they've got that. I think, you know, when I've chatted with Jonathan, when I've chatted with Mattia, they've definitely, you know, they understand that. Mattia especially is building a very strong technical, strategic technical plan. And they see this as long-term as well. You know, the board at Audi, they've got, you know, so the senior guys in the team have the backing of the board at Audi that this has to be a long-term thing, that you can't, you know, suddenly turn things around and Sauber aren't going to get podiums every single year, every single weekend. Even, you know, on the back of what happened at Silverstone. And it's the same for, you know, when it becomes Audi next year. I think that, you know, you're taking on a whole new power unit. They've developed the power unit for a long time, recently made some managerial changes, but, you know, it's to come into Formula One, regardless of what other motorsport series you've been successful in, is very, very difficult. And I think that if there's an understanding from the whole group, and there's a patience from Audi themselves, then they'll get there. They've got the right ingredients. They just need to keep adding capability, and they just need to keep, you know, they need to continue to think long-term whilst at the same time motivating the team and taking all the points on the table that they can in the short term. So I think that's probably what, you know, the likes of, you know, Mattia and Jonathan will be thinking now is just, you know, how do they keep the team motivated so they keep nicking points and maybe even outscore Williams? You know, that would be an unbelievable story, I would have thought, by the end of this year. But at the same time, have that really solid long-term plan in place that's going to start bearing fruit. But I did see Jonathan at Goodwood at the weekend, and he was extremely pleased with himself. And quite rightly so, I want to add, because he's a lovely man, like Dan said.
Well, if they are going to challenge Williams, they're going to need the second car to turn up with some points, because Bortoleto has only scored 11% of the points total that Hülkenberg has scored. We'll look at some more teammate comparisons in a moment. One that's not at all favourable, obviously, as we mentioned earlier on, is Red Bull, where the second car has scored just 7 points. But the numbers on Verstappen speak volumes for his situation. He's finished off the podium in over half of the races, 7 out of 12 this season. He went into Silverstone 61 points behind the championship leader, whereas in 2023 and 2024, remarkably, both times he was ahead in the championship at that same stage by 81 points. So that's the sort of net swing difference for Verstappen from this season compared to the previous ones. Jake, this has all led, amongst other things, to Christian Horner being removed from operational control of Red Bull Racing after 20 years. Where do you see Red Bull going for the rest of this season and into 2026?
It's got to be a transitional time. It needs to be, because there's just been this very extensive turnover of people. Obviously, losing a huge percentage of this sort of technical base that had been responsible for the championships over the past 3 years. There has been a lot of internal turmoil with regards to internal politics, certain factions emerging, kind of vying for the attention of the different shareholders at Red Bull. It was said that Horner had the sort of support of the Thai side of the business, and Helmut Marko had the support of the Austrian side of the business. And there now seems to be this sort of more unified front between the two different factions of shareholders, let's say. It needs to be a point at which you say, okay, right, the success now appears, you know, it hasn't been sustainable. There wasn't that harmony. I think last year, if anything, Max's championship came despite everything that happened at the team. So it's a difficult time, because you have to kind of conduct a whole rebuild, and it's not like it's the first time this has ever happened in Formula One. You know, empires rise, empires fall. It's all about how you rebuild them. And I think with Laurent Mekies now running the show, he has the support of the full gamut of shareholders. He has the support of the board. He's got the experience, you know, having been with Ferrari on the pit wall, having been in Formula One for a very, very long time. He's got the experience to make this happen, knows the right people. It's going to be a big job to rebuild this team, because there's a lot of moving parts. There's the powertrain project coming in for 2026, new wind tunnel expected as well. There's so many sort of big changes. it's going to take time to knit them all together and make them work out. And I think you can probably expect Red Bull not to be, let's say, they'll still be fighting at the front. You can never really discount them. You know, there's both Dan and Rob have alluded to, there's so many good people at that team. They just sort of maybe need that little bit of that motivation to get the ball rolling again. But yeah, there's a lot of changes at that team coming, more so now. And the question now is whether it has been able to retain Max Verstappen. And that's something that we'll find out in due course, because the prevailing theory is that either Horner was removed to keep the Verstappen camp happy, or that Horner was removed because he'd lost Verstappen. Now, we don't know the answer of that, and I'm sure we'll find out over the next couple of months, but that is going to be a key factor in driving that team forward, because I think without him this season, that team would be absolutely nowhere near the top four. I think it would be struggling to crack Q2, to be honest. So it is going to be a key factor in where that team shakes out over the next couple of years.
Dan, how do you see it? Laurent Mekies has gone in there, but what are the kind of building blocks, and do you believe, after the way that things have evolved in the last weeks and months, that Verstappen's more likely to stay at least into next year to sort of survey the lie of the land before making a move?
That's very difficult to say. I mean, it would be, the drivers are first and foremost competitors, aren't they? And then, you know, he will be looking to be in a team that can give him a car that means he can compete. He's obviously on the inside. He sees more, his team, his father see more than perhaps we do. And they will have a read on whether they think that's going to be capable. Now, clearly a team that's in a little bit of flux as they are now, is more of a risk maybe than a team that's been stable. So I'm sure that's a factor, but it's an incredibly difficult decision. And also, I don't know what their contractual situation is as well. But I think there's an inherent risk in moving team as well. You know, if you know the people are responsive to what the kind of things you want as a driver, you've seen that they're able to turn performance around in the past. I think that is a factor as well. It's not necessarily the grass is not necessarily greener. But in terms of their turnaround, there's no doubt the Red Bull are a sort of inflection point now. You know, there's been a huge amount that's happened. But let's not forget, it's not a Sauber, it's not an Aston Martin or a team that's building new facilities and building new capability. They are right up there with the best teams in terms of the people they've got, the facilities they have, and also the way those things mesh together. You know, a modern Formula One team has to have a state-of-the-art wind tunnel, but the wind tunnel they have is good enough. And they have state-of-the-art simulation facilities and all the other things you need. So they're not starting from scratch. It's a question, I think, as you've been saying, that of steadying the ship, you know, getting them to a certain amount of stability, and then proving that they can do what they do best. The real unknown remains the power unit. And obviously that's something that, you know, Laurent Mekies coming in is going to have to take on as well, where that is. But the regulations, we know that are coming in next year, they do allow for some kind of equalization if that's necessary. So they can look to that if they get into a situation where they feel that they're behind. Obviously, there's reliability and a lot of other things to worry about. I mean, I would be very worried if I was in his position. There's a lot to be nervous about, but equally, I just don't think we should forget that they are an incredibly capable team with the facilities and people that they need to do great things. And we've seen that, you know, only as a short time ago, as a couple of years. So, you know, they haven't all disappeared overnight. So I think they're definitely a team to watch. It'll be very interesting to see how they get on next year.
What about the numbers on Ferrari then, Rob? Lewis Hamilton was chasing down Hülkenberg for that podium in Silverstone, didn't get it. He's now gone 12 races into this season, a full half season, without scoring a podium in a Grand Prix. We had that sprint win, of course, in China, but we're talking about Grand Prix. He's without a podium. That's the longest drought of his F1 career. In contrast, Charles Leclerc has had 4 podiums and 3 front row starts, but still seems a long way off a race victory. Ferrari move into second in the Constructors' Championship, which is where they finished behind McLaren last season, and lots of pressure mounting on Fred Vasseur. He'll be looking, I guess, nervously at what's happened with Christian Horner, and Vasseur's contract expires at the end of this season. How do you read this evolving situation at Ferrari? And how different the reality halfway through this season is from all the kind of optimism that was around the team when Lewis joined at the beginning of the year?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, touching on the Lewis situation first, I mean, I think that if, you know, at the start of the season, he was struggling to get to grips with the car. It wasn't a car that he knew, you know, and I think making a transition from, as we were just chatting about, making a transition from one team to another, it always brings a learning period. There's always a certain amount of difficulty that is associated with that, which is less comfortable than your incumbent team, if you like, as a driver. So I think there should have always been a certain amount of expectation. I heard and read a lot about Lewis going there and whether or not Charles would be able to keep pace with him, or, you know, whether Charles would show him the way, which I think, quite frankly, is probably just a load of nonsense, because, you know, Charles is a very, very good driver. And he was always going to do a really, really good job. And he's very comfortable within that team as well. So to expect Lewis to step into that team with all of those unknowns and new challenges that we just talked about, I think was probably, you know, a little bit fantastical. But if you look at Lewis's performance now over the first part of the season, definitely in qualifying, he's getting closer and closer. So the gap now is coming down to something which is, you know, reasonably insignificant, whereas it started off a little bit bigger. They still have problems with the car. If we move to the team, you know, if you look at, I think there was a really nice microcosm of how that car behaves at the British Grand Prix, where Lewis was able to catch Nico Hülkenberg for that third position, but then wasn't really able to do anything with it. He never really mounted a challenge. You know, the closing speed of the car, of the two cars, was significant, if you like, in that Ferrari had an advantage. But once he got up there, the car started to slide about. It became more difficult, and then he kind of dropped back from him. So, and I think that's a microcosm of what the Ferrari can be like. So there is a lot of pressure. There's always a lot of pressure, right? You know, I remember when I first went to Ferrari, and somebody said to me, you know, Formula One is constant pressure. It's a pressure cooker, but there's the pressure cooker of Formula One, and then there's Ferrari. And I think they're right, because, you know, you are constantly under watch, especially the people who, you know, like talking about Fred, who is an extremely capable manager, by the way. But when you talk about people like Fred who are in the public eye, for people like that in Ferrari, there's an extra layer of pressure, if you like, because the media like to comment on your job and how well you're doing, which is never a comfortable position to be in for anyone, I don't think. So Fred, I think he'll be more than aware than anybody that the team has to pick up its performance. I think they were expecting much more from this season, especially with Lewis coming in. Maybe that's, you know, that wasn't all justified, and it's a period where they do have to kind of build the team around Lewis and Charles, and get a car that they are both comfortable. And it's just the little things with Ferrari, right? It's not that they're a million miles away. And it's not like they're imploding internally. I think Fred's done a very good job since he's come in of rallying the troops, of getting the team to work together. But it's just the tiny things that every now and again they let themselves down with. And it's just the tiny things, I think, with the car. But, you know, you can't. We talked about this a little bit with Audi. You can't only focus on if Ferrari now make the old mistake of just focusing on the next race, they will never get themselves into world championship winning positions. They have to focus on, they have to take a more strategic outlook. They have to essentially take their medicine and continue to do that, but have long-term plans that will see them get into a winning position. And eventually, you know, that you can go from winning to dominant, but it means that you have, you know, there's a lot of things that have to fall into place, a little bit like what we're seeing with McLaren now. So Fred is under a lot of pressure. I think it would personally B, but I'm not on the inside and don't know all the details, it would personally be a mistake to make a change at the end of the year when Fred is out of contract, because I do think he's done a lot of good things there, and has to be given the time. You know, the family and the board has to give you know, the senior management and the operational management of the team the time and the space to be able to do their job. So we'll see how it plays out.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Okay, well, just to round things out then, let's look at a few teammate comparisons and what we can learn for the second half of the season. George Russell is now 18 points behind Verstappen in the Drivers' Championship, having won in Canada, 5 podium visits for the Brit this year. His teammate Antonelli, of course, 18-year-old rookie this year, podium in Canada, made him the 3rd youngest podium finisher in F1 history after Verstappen and Stroll. His 63 points for 7th in the championship is just 42% of what Russell has scored. So not too bad for a rookie, but I think everybody will be looking to him to step up and close that gap in the second half of the season. In terms of who's doing best and worst relative to their teammate compared to Antonelli, Carlos Sainz, rather surprisingly, only on 28% of the points that Alex Albon has scored at Williams. And that's part of the reason why they're getting into the sights of Sauber, as we mentioned earlier on in the Constructors' Championship. So Sainz certainly needs to have a stronger second half of the season. Behrmann, another rookie, just 26% of the points that Ocon has scored. And Bortoleto, as I mentioned earlier, just 11% of Hülkenberg's points. But the most extreme example, without doubt, is Alpine, where the second car has scored 0 points compared to Gasly's 19. So certainly a few changes we're anticipating there. Jake, there were some rumours after Silverstone, which was Colapinto's 6th race. Doohan had 6 earlier in the season. That was Colapinto's 6th. I'm not sure he's necessarily done any better than Doohan did. So what's your money on for, does he get dropped now? Does Doohan come back? What do Alpine do next?
God only knows. I think it just seems to be a little bit of a, I don't know how to put it, to be honest, because it just seems to be complete indecision on that second seat. Arguably, Alpine let one of its better prospects in Victor Martin leave at the end of last season. And I think, you know, when you look at his qualifying performances in F2, and he's an incredibly gutsy racer as well, I think he would have been really, really good for that team. Maybe they just didn't want to go with the all-French angle again for a third year in a row, maybe. I don't know. But they went for Doohan, but it seemed like his days were numbered before he even got in the car, having to bat off questions at the F175 event about Colapinto being signed. Colapinto coming in with loads of hype after his Williams stint at the end of last season, but it just hasn't kicked on at all. Reckons that the car is very, very different to drive than the Williams, which of course it would be, but I think sort of coming in with actually some kind of reference might have hurt him a little bit, because he's just finding it very, very difficult to adapt, throwing it into the wall much more often than he should be doing, which, again, it's a rookie thing to do, and you kind of expect that. But he just hasn't kicked on in the weekends that he doesn't throw it into the wall. I think Canada showed that Colapinto could be on it and he could qualify well. And, you know, strategy providing, he can put in a good race performance, but the pace hasn't been there. And Gasly is the driver where if you give him a situation, he'll absolutely make the most of it. It's difficult with that Alpine, because also in terms of qualifying pace, it's very, very good. Looking at kind of the list of super times where you kind of take the, let's say, fastest time as a function of the theoretical best, Alpine theoretically has the 7th fastest car, and in qualifying, Gasly's able to put it in Q3 pretty regularly, but its tyre management capabilities are not very good. And you see actually Haas and Sauber, which have theoretically slower cars, surpassing it. So for the second seat, It's anyone's game, isn't it? Valtteri Bottas has been linked to it. I think the rules say that you can only have four drivers unless in case of force majeure. So that would mean that if they had to make a further change, you know, that would put Doohan or Colapinto back in the seat. I don't see either of them in that car next year. And I think they're trying to... I think they do have an offer on the table for Bottas, actually. Perez has been linked to the team. There's options out there. It just seems to be very... Let's put it charitably and say very dynamic at the moment in that second seat. But yeah, I'm not really sure what they want to do with it, to be quite honest.
Well, in terms of the qualifying head-to-head, Gasly's 5-1 against Doohan and 5-1 against Colapinto. If we look at some of the other teams, it's a clean sweep for Verstappen, 2-0 against Lawson in qualifying and 10-0 against Tsunoda. Interestingly, Alonso in your old team, Dan, has got a clean sweep too, 12-0 against Stroll. Piastri 7, Norris 5, so he's currently got the qualifying advantage. Leclerc 8-4 against Lewis Hamilton, which I think is surprising a number of people given how much optimism there was around Lewis at the start of the year. It's 11-1 to Russell at Mercedes. Ocon and Behrman, interestingly, is 6 apiece, so honours even between the two of them. Hadjar and Lawson 8-2, Hadjar and Tsunoda 1-1 each. Albon and Sainz is 7-5 in Albon's favour, and it's 6 apiece between Hülkenberg and Bortoleto. So Behrman, Bortoleto and Hadjar, those three rookies, doing a pretty solid job so far this season. Just to wrap us up then, the second half of this year, the attention for the teams will all be focusing on 2026. There is a world championship to be won. There are valuable positions, of course, this year in the Constructors' Championship, which pays out the prize money, so you can't give up on it. But Dan, to finish off, a very experienced man at coming up with cars for major rule changes, how will the Formula One teams be thinking about the second half of the season and this massive rule change coming in 2026? Put us in the technical director's seat. How are you approaching it?
There'll certainly be a lot going on. There'll be a lot of sleepless nights at this time of year. What's interesting for this regulation change is that there wasn't any aerodynamic development allowed to be done before the beginning of this year. So that has slightly changed the dynamics, because in a rule change, typically the teams would be thinking about starting work on that new regulation set much earlier than that, almost to the point where, you know, there's a feeling that the earlier you can start, the better off you'll be, even if the regulations haven't quite matured to the point where you know exactly what they're going to be. And obviously, you carry some risk with it, but that is definitely something you think about. So, you know, that decision has been taken away from them to some extent, and I don't think there'll be any team that waited past the 1st of January to start doing their aero development, because it is relatively late, especially for a major change like that. In terms of the mechanics of how it works after that point, you do have the opportunity with the kind of resources available in your team, particularly in sort of mechanical and, you know, composites design engineering, you do have the ability to still put updates on your car this year. It usually gets to about this time of year or a little bit earlier, probably May time, May, June time, where that resource then kind of disappears because it has to be used for the following year's car. And remember, these teams are under cost cap. So, you know, you can't just hire more design engineers or hire a load of contractors to do it. So, you know, it is quite tight for the number of people. So they'll be well into making chassis designs and, you know, perhaps even making chassis at this time of year, which means that that resource to sort of put parts on the car is not readily available, or you're taking it away, which is not good. And then from the development side of things, you know, the teams again are limited by the cost cap, and they'll not want to be leaving aerodynamicists on this year's car while they could be doing useful work on the next year's car. You know, if you might have 30 or 40 aerodynamicists, you're going to have four or five people at the very minimum to work on that. And that's resource that could usefully be used. You know, I mean, and it really is a race against time with 2026. I mean, teams may, you know, from a very sort of low baseline, they might be thinking about this year putting 20-25% extra downforce on the car, for example. So every week that you're delaying that by having people not on that project is, you know, percentages of downforce that aren't available. And, you know, that's critical come the start of the season. So these are the kind of things they'll be thinking about. I don't think there'll be any team that is wanting to spend any effort on development on this year's car. But they have done. We've seen that with updates. But I think it will almost certainly be done by a skeleton crew. And everybody's focus at this point of the season will now be 100% on 2026.
Great stuff. Well, that will do us. Thank you very much to Dan Fallows, to Rob Smedley, and to Jake Boxall-Legg. Check out Dan's Substack, very interesting analysis on Formula One. And you can read all of Jake's insightful F1 work on Autosport and Motorsport. Rob, where can people find you, apart from the headquarters, the global headquarters of Smedley Group?
In my garden? On my shed? Oh, sorry. I don't know. What are we on now? FatKartingLeague.com. Go and have a look at that and check us out if you want to get into motorsport.
Yeah, Rob is doing all he can to democratize motorsport and the entry to it, and long may that continue. Check out all the latest F1 news and insights from the Grand Prix on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. If you want to find out more about the Global F1 Fan Survey that we recently released and download your own copy, the link is in the episode description notes. Some very, very interesting stuff about who's following Formula One and fan attitudes and how they've evolved and changed in the last few years. Do join our Fantasy League community. Check out the motorsport.com details or the episode description notes. And remember to send in all your comments and questions to @JamesAllenOnF1 on X. My thanks to producer Dre, to producer Matt, and to producer Ben. And thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow, leave us a review, and tell all of your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.
You've been listening to the James Allen on F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, check out the Autosport F1 channel, wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple and Spotify.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.